This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Bob Komsic.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Saturday edition of the best of Fight Back from the week that was. It began with the latest Toronto hate crime statistics, most of which are anti-Semitic, followed by hate crimes against the LGBTQ and Black communities. Meantime, Stephen Del Duca, mayor of Vaughan's, proposing a new measure to control those unruly pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas demonstrations, some of which have targeted and intimidated local Jewish communities. He wants to bring in a bylaw that would prohibit protests outside places of worship, schools, childcare facilities, and hospitals that incite hatred, intolerance, and violence. This follows acts of intimidation that we've seen outside a synagogue, a hospital, and directed at a Jewish community over the last few weeks. Libby wanted to know what Monday's Zoomer Squad makes of police enforcement of the laws. She was joined by John Wright, Executive Vice President, Maru Public Opinion, John Mikitishin, President of Bradgate Research, and Bob Richardson, Head of Hammersmith Consulting.
I think our police have been borderline useless on this topic. And I think that's a huge part of the problem here. They, has anyone been arrested about the protest at Mount Sinai? Has anyone been arrested breaking the law involving the bridge over the highway? There's been borderline activities at universities. OCAD comes to mind. And frankly, the police have been slow, late, or they haven't acted at all. So there's been a bit of a malaise, I think, among our police. And I think they have to it has to be made clear that this is a priority and they have to put the necessary resources into it. And quite frankly, I think we could use an injection of some dynamic leadership, but it's not been great. And the statistics speak for themselves.
John Mikitishin, I mean, what is up with this? Is there any reason that the police seem to be so delicate with this particular population?
Yeah, I wonder if today we're not in a competition for who's more afraid. People who are being victimized by these hate incidents or the police for doing their jobs. Like, in all seriousness, you know, Bob is bang on. And it's like, you know, I went to a rally for, you know, a political rally last week. And totally before I left my house, on my mind was, is there going to be a rally? Am I going to have to go through a mob? I'm sure there'll be an abundance of police cars there, but will they do anything? Before I left my house without any idea, I assumed that I would have to put myself in a difficult situation. Now, I was driving to something. I can't imagine people who have to live with this, having these people come into their neighborhoods. And frankly, I don't know what it's going to take for the police to do their job or the police boards, which are the people that are supposed to be telling the police what to do when people are unhappy with them. Is it going to cause somebody to get killed at one of these protests before action is actually taken? Because I know the chief came out today and gave some numbers. We charged this many people. Right. So what he's saying is he's charged less than 1% of any of the people involved in any of the incidents that have been reported in the last year.
John, you're a pollster. So what are people in favor of more enforcement? Because it seems to me on Demkew's speech, part of what he's saying, this give us more money. We need money for this.
I don't think it's really going to be about more money. It's really about attitude, as we've put. And I think the second thing is we really have to, you know, take a look at the police and see what their mandate is supposed to be in this circumstance. Is it actually to intervene and to lay a bunch of charges, or is it to manage the situation to keep the public peaceful? And I say that in the sense of, even on the weekend, if we'd seen the police on the barricades or lining up downtown, the group, you know, that's there protesting, as energetic as it is, also overwhelms the police. It's one thing to say, wade into a crowd and do something about it. It's another thing to try and do something. and then cause it into a riot or something even more. So I'm not giving excuses for this. I'm just saying that, you know, trying to manage, you know, 10,000 people at Young and Bloor in the evening when you've only got so many police officers and riot squad people who can do that, we just have to go back to the G20 and see what that effect was. Going down the main streets of Queen Street and some other places. So, you know, what do you do with a crowd that overwhelms police, that's in a volatile situation? Do you wade in? Do you do that sort of thing? Or do you wait until after to follow up and find some other way to contain the damage or to contain the hate that could be brought into neighborhoods? And I think that's the delicate. I'm not an expert in this stuff. I just kind of look at the numbers. But I think that's the balancing act that's being, you know, that has to be taken into account here.
John Wright, Executive Vice President, Maru Public Opinion, John Mikitishin, President of Bradgate Research Group, and Bob Richardson, President, Hammersmith Consulting, this week's Zoomer Squad. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Bob Komsic for Jane Brown. U.S. Congress has moved a big step closer to a crackdown on TikTok, threatening to ban the Chinese-controlled platform unless the U.S. subsidiary is sold to Americans. What does this mean for Canada? Turns out the federal Liberals ordered a national security review of TikTok last September, but did not disclose it publicly until recently. Joining Libby to further discuss, Phil Gursky, former senior strategic terrorism analyst at CSIS and president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, Philip Mai, co-director of the Social Media Lab at Ted Rogers School of Management at Toronto Metropolitan University, and Rigatoni Garrido, artist and animator.
My small business does, in fact, heavily rely on a lot of attention that comes from the social media platforms that I currently post my videos and illustrations on. But I do have a small concern about the data breach in terms of, like, my own small personal business. I mean, it's already hard enough as an independent artist to secure, you know, work and income. So it kind of just, it feels as though, like, I have to watch out for another risk, whether it's securing commissions or making content that may or may not be popular. You know, now I have to worry about, you know, a potential breach in my personal data and for my own personal business. You know, am I going to get attacked and that type of thing?
And how much of your business would you say you get from that, from TikTok?
I would like to say at least 65% of my sales heavily rely on the traffic on TikTok. Some of it also comes from Instagram, but I have a lot more attention and followers on TikTok.
Philip Mai, does that surprise you? And why would TikTok, with very short spurts of video, generate so much more business than, say, Instagram?
Well, people are busy, and Instagram is designed in such a way that you can consume a lot of content very quickly. So I'm not surprised at all, because that's the trend that we've been seeing for at least the last 5 years now. We do a survey every 2 years where we ping 1,500 Canadians and say, hey, where are you spending time online? And TikTok is one of the fastest growing social network in Canada and in the U.S. So, yeah, it's in line with what we've been seeing. It's very valuable for creators who have things that they want to get in front of the public because of the way the algorithm is designed. It allows you to consume a lot of content very quickly.
One of the things that is said about TikTok is that they mine a lot of personal information, even more than other social media sites, and the Chinese government can get access to it at any time. Philip Mai.
That's one of the concerns. The kind of data they collect is similar to the kind of data that's collected by all of the other social media apps that are out there. What's concerning is the fact that the company is subject to Chinese law, and there's a concern that if the Chinese government were to request this data, we will not know until after the fact whether they have chosen to comply. The company says that they will not. But again, if they choose to do it, we won't know about it until after the fact. And that's the concern.
Phil Gursky. Again, Rigatoni was, she says she's now concerned about security on top of everything else. So should Canadians who use TikTok to promote their businesses to get sales, do they have to be concerned?
Well, I think anytime you use social media, Libby, you have to know, you know, who's controlling it, who's using the information, whether it's TikTok, whether it's Facebook, whether it's LinkedIn, whether it's X. I understand the use of social media as a former CSIS analyst, now on the out. You know, I use social media to talk about things like national security. You and I have talked for years about these types of issues. So I get it, but it's all about being careful, and it's all about what are you willing to put out there? And if it's compromised, is it going to make a big deal to you? Only you can make that decision. My fear here is with TikTok is the horse has already left the barn. China's been doing this for years. If TikTok is banned or sold to a U.S. company, whatever, they will simply find another method in which to gather information and harass Canadians. So I'm not saying we should do it or not do it. I'm just saying the problem is a huge one, and it doesn't get resolved easily by simply deciding to ban TikTok from Canada.
Phil Gursky, former senior strategic terrorism analyst at CSIS, as well as president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, Rigatoni Garrido, artist and animator, and Philip Mai, co-director of the Social Media Lab at Ted Rogers School of Management at Toronto Metropolitan University. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back. I'm Bob Komsic. Coming up after the break, the controversial NDP motion on the future of the Middle East.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Bob Komsic on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Bob Komsic in for Jane Brown. Friction within the Trudeau government after the Commons passed an amended NDP motion on Palestinian statehood. Several Liberals feel it was better, but think the party should have just voted down the original motion rather than trying to change it. The head of the Israel Foreign Ministry's North America Division says Israel's in talks to try to get Ottawa to reverse its restrictions on arms exports, adding doing so inhibits his country's ability to defend itself. The official also predicts the outcome of the vote will be celebrated by Hamas. Libby checked in with the Recovering Politicians panel. Janet Ecker, former Ontario Conservative MPP and Finance Minister. Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario New Democrat. And George Smitherman, former Ontario Liberal Cabinet Minister.
Well, I suppose it's easy to say that what we do here is irrelevant to what's happening in Israel and in Palestine, etc. But at the same time, I think for tens of millions of Canadians, it is relevant. And while the sometimes democracy is, you know, characterized as a sausage making exercise that you don't really want to watch, I feel like the resolution where they landed is, you know, I think quite aligned with where many of our allies are, including the United States, with respect to a two-state solution, and many, if not most, European nations, etc. So I don't see it as a futile effort. I think that in the circumstances, which are very severe, it's important for Canadian Parliament to be on the record. And, you know, I think that the motion that was eventually supported is fairly good at reflecting where I imagine many of the points of view and sympathies are of Canadians.
Sherry, I mean, in terms of an NDP constituency, the NDP is trying to put this forward as a victory. I don't see how they can do that.
Well, I think it is in the sense that it represents over 70% of Canadians want either a permanent ceasefire, want to see either a permanent ceasefire or a temporary one. We've got a situation where 13,000 children have died, where 1.2 million people are in risk of starvation. The House was totally agreed that, you know, Hamas is a terrorist organization. They're not the legitimate government of Gaza, and everybody kind of gets that, I think. The reality is that the children and the women and the others are are victims. And I think, you know, the desire that Canadians expressed in that motion was, we need peace and we need it now. This is not helping the government of Israel on the world stage. Some 139 countries want to see Palestine as a state. That's our stated opinion, as a two-state solution. But we're no closer to that after decades of negotiations. So a degree of frustration, but mainly just a real hunger and longing on behalf of Canadians and the majority of parliamentarians for peace.
Janet, in terms of Canada's influence, you know, a lot of conservatives say that Canada does not have any kind of stature anymore. Do you agree with that?
I think we've blown a lot of our global reputation over the last couple of years. You know, we used to be considered a strong middle power leader on some initiatives, et cetera. And we've just let our soft power and our military, frankly, our defense and NATO, et cetera, we've let that deteriorate. So, you know, are we still worth having around the table? I certainly hope so. But I can understand why a lot of our allies just shake their heads when they think of Canada. But the other thing about this as well is that, you know, it's fine to say, yeah, we need the two-state solution and all of that. But you're absolutely right. This is going to take a lot of parties at the table to make this happen. And it's going to take Hamas to surrender, to back off. I mean, we had a ceasefire. We had a ceasefire until October the 6th. And so it's going to take the Arabs, it's going to take a lot of players at the table to make it happen. I mean, and Sherry's right. I mean, everybody wants peace. Everybody wants this to stop. Everybody wants kids to stop being harmed and starved and all of that. But at the same time, if it were that easy, it would have happened. So I'm quite not optimistic about it at all, quite frankly. But I hope that the players can get together with some of the Arab states as well. And the thing we have to keep remembering, too, is Israel is a democratic country. It's the only democratic country in that zone. And I think that says a lot about who we should be trying to help support.
Janet Ecker, former Ontario PC MPP and finance minister, Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario New Democrat MPP, and George Smitherman, former provincial Liberal cabinet minister. The Recovering Politicians Panel. You're listening to the Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Bob Komsic. A new study suggests intermittent fasting may drastically increase the risk of death due to cardiovascular disease. Researchers looked at intermittent fasting, which limits eating to a specific number of hours each day that may range from a 4 to 12-hour time window. Libby got the thoughts from the medical record panel. Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician, founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto, and Dr. Malcolm Moore, oncologist, Princess Margaret Cancer Center.
If you actually read the article, the comment I agreed with the most was one of the cardiologists who was asked about it, who said, look, you know, I'm not going to base any decisions on a study where people filled out a dietary questionnaire for 2 days and then were monitored for the next 20 years. I don't think we can draw firm conclusions from that. And so I think it's really hard to say, you know, because this is self-reported diet over a two-day period. And if you look further in the article, they did find out that the people who said they were doing this type of diet, in terms of their all-cause mortality, did they live longer than people who didn't diet like this, or did they live shorter? There was no difference in that. And one of the other problems with these massive studies where you look at multiple things, they probably looked at cardiac disease, obesity, cancer, car accidents, suicide. Whenever you do multiple comparisons, inevitably some of those comparisons seem to show an apparent difference, but that's just because you're doing a lot of analyses.
Elisa, do any of your patients swear by this, or have they asked you about it?
Absolutely. This is a common diet that is brought up to find out if they can do it or they're doing it. This has sort of replaced a ketogenic diet that was very popular maybe like 6-7 years ago. People don't come in and talk about that anymore. People will come in and talk about intermittent fasting and say that they're fasting.
It's interesting. This study is not a very rigorous study. This is not a randomized controlled trial. This is an observational study, as Dr. Moore has mentioned, that it's based on 2 days of diet information that then they project out for 10 years to determine mortality. And as we've talked on other shows about the chicken wings, that people think that during this window of time you can go and eat whatever. Well, you can. It depends on the quality of the food and what you're eating. And I think one of the arguments in terms of whether or not this diet works is that you're actually reducing the calories that you're eating during this window, eating a lot of food. It sort of defeats the purpose of this type of intervention. So for some people, they find that it really works. For other people, they find that it doesn't. And I think it just sort of shows that you have to find what works for you. There's no magic diet that will work for everybody. It has never been found, and it won't be found. It's what you feel will work for you. And if this is a mechanism that allows you to consume less calories in a day, then it will be helpful. But you have to eat properly during this window.
And Dr. Spiegelman, I mean, every other study shows that if you lose weight on it and your blood pressure goes down and other cardiovascular indicators, that's healthy, as opposed to risking more cardiovascular disease, no?
As someone who does intermittent fasting intermittently, I don't do it all the time. I've looked into a lot of the previous studies and read Jason Fung's book, who's the expert in the Canada and the world on this. And there are definite benefits in terms of weight loss, decreasing your cholesterol, diabetes improving. So there's lots of other benefits that are well documented in other studies. And there has to be something to intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating. If you think about it, every major religion has some kind of fasting in their as part of their religion. Right now we're in Ramadan for the Muslims, there's Lent for Christians, and there's Yom Kippur for Jews. So there's something historical about fasting that has benefit to health. And what I see with myself, but also the patients that I see and friends that do intermittent fasting, is you don't only get the long-term health benefits. What I find is you do get the mental health benefits. You feel more awake and alert with it. And of course, you have to watch what you're eating when you're eating, when you're in the eating phase of the day. And obviously, it does come down to calories in and calories out in terms of weight gain and benefit as well. So you have to eat healthy while you intermittent fast.
The Medical Record Panel. Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Dr. Lisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore, oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. You're listening to the Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Bob Compson. Still to come, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the Best of Fight Back with Bob Comsic.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Walter in Hamilton wants to see harsher penalties in the wake of new hate crime stats.
What I'd like to see happen, really, in all of this, is that I find that the intolerant who attack another person, let's say because they're Jewish or because they're LGBT or because they're black or a different race, should face a serious penalty of no less than 20 years in prison without parole. If we put the good bite, the good teeth into the law, it should help deter.
Frank in Concord wanted to talk about the problem with auto thefts.
Well, who do we have at the Port Authority? We got Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles. They don't see anything. They don't see all this deception and things going on. And we have the government and the auto manufacturers. You can't figure out how to not have your car stolen.
Carolyn in Bowmanville looked at long-term care at home.
This whole situation is very close to home for our family. My son-in-law has an incurable brain disorder to the point where there has to be home care. Being at home sounds like it's ideal, but if you're at home with only PSWs who come in for supposedly an hour but don't stay that long, and there is no family present because they have to work, you're by yourself.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Lewis in Toronto, who does not see the harm in intermittent fasting.
Did they ever consider the capacity of the stadium? Because I was reading that BMO, they had to put in another 5,000 feet or seats to bring it up to 45,000.
That's right.
Because they only had 40. And the 40,000 is nothing compared to other major cities that have bigger stadiums.
That does it for today's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us between noon and 1 weekdays, or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca, follow us on X at Fightback Libby, and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime, 416-367-9636. I'm Bob Comsic for Jane Brown. Join me again at the same time tomorrow when we'll round up the rest of the Best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Zeev Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.